Welcome to Friday, and welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Spend an hour with us now, and you'll understand what happened this week. For example, this week Seattle's public school strike was suspended after the teachers' union reached a tentative agreement with the district. Union membership still has to vote on that. The union's president, Jonathan Knapp, is here right now. Jonathan, welcome.
Hey, it's great to be here, Bill.
Are you going to approve this deal?
That's up to the membership.
What vote are you recommending to the membership?
So personally, I don't recommend anything. The bargaining team puts forward a recommendation, which was to approve. And then the board of directors and the representative assembly both have made a recommendation to approve.
I don't hear your enthusiasm. How will you vote? Or have
actually,
you?
I don't get to vote. It's not in my job.
Well, how do you feel? What happened this week? How do you feel about the contract that teachers got with the district, the tentative agreement?
I'm very proud of our bargaining team and the work we did. The members were very passionate out on the lines. We moved the discussion to new places that have never been broached before in a contract bargain, probably anywhere, not certainly in Washington State, maybe nowhere in the country. We broke a lot of new ground. Of course, you don't always get everything you want in any situation, in any bargain. So there's some ups and downs, but you know, I feel really good about the work that our members did.
For example, you got a raise, 3% in the first year, 2% in the second, 4.5% in the third, plus your state cost of living raise. That's less than you wanted. How do you feel about teacher pay in Seattle now?
Still is marginal. I mean, this really focuses the attention of the legislature on the McCleary decision and how much they need to step forward on educator compensation.
You got a guaranteed 30 minutes of recess. You got racial equity teams. What are those?
So the school district has been under investigation by the U.S. Department of Justice for disproportionate discipline for African-American boys. So that's an example of what we're talking about. Our equity teams are designed to have our members in the schools looking at the data around student discipline and making proposals and pioneering solutions about how to make discipline more equitable in our schools.
You got more input on testing schedules. The test scores will not be used in teacher evaluations. Mm-hmm. Limits on caseloads for school therapists. I know this will sound simplistic, but who won the strike, if anyone?
I'll give you a simplistic answer. I think we did.
Also with us this hour to say more about that, from the free market think tank, the Washington Policy Center, Paul Guppy. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning.
Jonathan Knapp says the union won the strike overall. What do you say to that?
Sure. As far as looking at the dynamics of it, as a parent, I'm just relieved mostly that it's resolved one way or the other. I agree with Jonathan that I think the union came out pretty well. They seem to get most of what they were trying to get. But the main thing I was concerned about was just the impact on families across the city during the strike, including mine. So today my daughter's back in school and we're very happy about that.
In fact, last week you accused Jonathan's union of striking at the expense of kids and families. It was only 6 days. Do you stand by that?
Well, I do, in the sense that we have to be realistic about the effect that this has on families in their day-to-day life. It's very disruptive. And as I said before, it sends a troubling signal about conflict within the system. So whenever grown-ups are able to get together and resolve things without going to extremes, that's always better. But I guess the other point I was trying to make is how sort of powerless and helpless a lot of families feel, because they're just you receive a robocall at home at night and it says, you know, school is closed tomorrow. So and parents talk to each other. So there's a frustration about the lack of influence or decision that parents have. They see these other forces within the system kind of driving everything. And when the district and the union come to an agreement and improve the compensation package for teachers and get at the other issues you mentioned about recess and helping kids, that's very good. I mean, we're glad that that's been settled. But meanwhile, parents and caregivers are the passive spectators to this entire event. And all they're doing anxiously is just waiting for it to be over, so that kids' education can go forward and that life can return to a more normal routine.
I don't personally know anyone who can go through life without being at the mercy of forces beyond their control, but you are you're a free market guy. In the free market, if you want to pay me less than I want to work for, we don't have a contract, and so I'm not working until we can come to an agreement. What's the free market problem with that?
Well, again, it's public education, so it's a monopoly. There's one size fits all. You're assigned to a school based on your zip code. If you can't, you only have two other choices. If you can't afford private school tuition, and you can't afford to move your house and move to another school district or another part of the city or the state, and you have children, you know, you have a choice of one. That's the public school. And I can tell you from long experience, when you interact with the school district, they tell you what you're going to do. And there are choices. You know, we've used counseling services. There are other options. There are educational programs. Those are good. Parents can choose those. But it's always within a menu that's selected by the school district.
Before I introduce our other panelists, I think I should let monopolist Jonathan Knapp respond to that from the Seattle Teachers Union.
This isn't an issue about markets in my mind. This is an issue about communities and what we're trying to accomplish. Paul described parents as sort of sitting it out. I didn't see parents sitting this out. Parents were on the picket line with us. Parents were emailing, we're calling, we're talking to the school board. They felt that the issues that we were standing up for kids were their issues. This is about community activism. This is not a market analysis.
Also with us, former Seattle Mayor Greg Nichols. Good to see you again.
Good morning.
From your perspective, what happened this week? What was accomplished in this strike and maybe settlement?
Well, I think there were a couple of interesting dynamics away from the bargaining table, and that was there were community members out on those picket lines. I went by.
How unusual is that?
Well, I don't know.
Pretty unusual, let me tell you.
Yeah, but there were people bringing snacks and treats for the teachers. Parents and kids were marching with the teachers. So I think that it helped generate a conversation about education that otherwise would not have occurred. And so I'm pleased that the Seattle teachers took the risk of going out there and generating that conversation. We're in a state where the legislature is being held in contempt by the Supreme Court because of their failure to fully fund basic education. They went through I think they've now adjourned, but I'm not absolutely sure of that, after three or four special sessions, still not really dealing with
it. You never know.
And so it's an important conversation for us to have in our communities among parents and Seattle educators helped us to face up to that, I think.
From the Seattle Channel's Civic Cocktail, hi, Joni Balter.
Hello.
What was accomplished this last week with the strike and the agreement?
Well, let me start by saying I personally hate strikes, as do a lot of folks. But, Jonathan, you are the master of understatement here. the teachers won. There's no maybe about that. They won a lot of things. They won money, but then they were able, and this is where I don't get the argument about the parent. The parents definitely are inconvenienced. But the reason they won, or one of the reasons they won, has to do with the fact that they worked the community support. The parents were with them. That's what was most notable about this. Normally, let's do your garden variety strike. You have the parents lamenting that the teachers are only thinking about themselves and not the kids. But the parents were with you.
Right.
That's why you sailed to victory, shall we say, here.
And that was a conscious strategy on our part. We started organizing in the parent community a couple of years ago.
Let us talk about that conscious strategy. That's the most interesting thing to me about this strike. Is the Mayor Nichols referred to it as a conversation that would not have occurred otherwise. Joni talked about parental support. So, again, public school students back in school, the strike could resume if union members don't approve the contract this weekend. And in a moment, we get at this bigger question. Teachers' unions have been publicly bashed the last several years. Teachers are, Jonathan, you're self-interested. You protect your jobs. You're not accountable. You don't innovate.
That's right.
You've heard it.
All those things that we've heard over the years.
In this strike, the public conversation was different. It was as much about recess and testing and racial equity as it was about wages and benefits and job protections. And the national media emphasized that. So I want to know.
Let me just add one nuance there.
Yes.
Teacher pay is actually a community issue, too. You cannot attract and retain great teachers if you don't pay them a wage that can help them live in the communities that they work in.
That's the conversation that you want the city, the state, to be having. So I want to know, how did Seattle's image of teachers' unions change over this last week? Is America's image of public unions and teachers changing right before us? That's in a moment on KUOW's Week in Review. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. For the last few minutes, we've been telling you who got what in the Seattle teachers' strike. I'll tell you, the national media are playing this as a win for the teachers, and here's why. The storyline is that the teachers, instead of just bargaining for higher wages and benefits, also a social issue, says the union, instead of just bargaining about money, which is seen as about them, the teachers, they made it about all of us. That's what I've read of the national media, that teachers in Seattle took social issues that parents and voters care about, like standardized testing, racial and social equity, recess for kids, and they put those front and center. So first of all, does anyone on our panel this hour dispute that account of this strike? Is that what happened?
That's absolutely what happened.
Even Washington Policy Center's Paul Guppy says that's what happened.
I can follow the news as well as anyone else.
So okay.
That was what was occurring.
Okay, but it's not just the narrative that some like teachers' union spin meisters wanted people to hear. That's you agree that that's what happened. And I heard you say that's unusual. That was different this week, right?
And that was a conscious strategy for us. I mean, we thought about cutting issues that would resonate with the parent community.
This is Jonathan Knapp, president of the Seattle Education Association, the teachers union, saying this is a very conscious strategy.
Well, look at where they picked up some of their key support. There were, before this all happened, many rebellions at different high schools, Garfield High School among them, where folks were sick and tired of so much testing, over-testing, whatever you would like to call it. So pulling that in and perhaps wrapping your salary increases and other things in that was a great strategy, because then you had the folks who were already riled up about something, in that case, too much testing and too much evaluating and too much time taken from learning to help with all the other issues.
So, yes, Paul.
Well, yeah, exactly. So, again, I guess what we're seeing is the underlying symptom of the involuntary nature of the system, the relationship that families have with the district. And so, naturally, there are frustrations that come up in schools about testing, about recess, about how disciplinary policy towards kids, because the school district is, and Jonathan would probably recognize this, is extremely bureaucratic, slow, not very responsive. But in private education, schools, parents are much more engaged and schools are more responsive. That is, if you can afford to go to a private school. And so these issues are out there. And so I think it was smart of the union to see that if they incorporated the concerns of parents about these other non-economic issues, that they were able to convey that message. And of course, the union is, as I said before, is far more powerful within the system than parents are. And so they accomplished a lot of good reforms because of that.
And I do want to say, is it okay?
Yes. Jonathan Knapp.
You can explain where I'm wrong.
No, I mean, there are some elements that you're right on. I mean, the district is big and it is somewhat bureaucratic. Educators, however, are not. They are the frontline contact with parents. We are the people who are talking to parents about what the experience is for their kids and their lives, and, mm-hmm. and we get the immediate feedback. So, we are part of the system, too. You know, we work in it. And you know, the union has consciously wanted to position ourselves as the more responsive feedback loop for parents.
And Jonathan, you have said that there is a culture war going on that the teachers union picked up on and sided on. Tell me about that.
Actually, I sat down with the vice president of AFT, which is not my union, just earlier in the week, and had a good conversation with her. She's originally from St. Paul, and we kind of looked back on the history here a little bit and actually recognized that we think that there's sort of a turning of the tide here in America around education issues. There's been a lot of heavy criticism from the private sector and from some of the privatizers and the commercialization trend in public education. But in the last 4 or 5 years, I think that the tide has turned a little bit and communities are realizing what a valuable public resource public education is, what a crucial sort of building block for American democracy it is. And that's something that we can't lose. And educators, have felt a little bit put upon here in recent years, have been criticized a lot. And I think that in places like Seattle, at least, and we saw it in St. Paul and in Chicago, coming together to stand up for public education, a vital American democratic institution.
Former Mayor Greg Nickels, do you agree that was this strike just a 6-day local thing, or do you also see a turning of the tide that Seattle and America is connecting? Chicago, St. Paul, is there? the conversation is turning about public unions and teachers unions. What do you see?
Well, I don't think it was just Seattle. I think the Seattle teachers were on the front line, but I think teachers all over our region and state were watching and cheering and hoping that that this conversation would take place and that reforms would happen. So I think they were the front guard, but there are a lot of people who have a stake in this in addition to Seattle Education Association. I don't know what's happening in St. Paul and Chicago and elsewhere. I know we've had very interesting conversations in states like Kansas and Oklahoma about what should and should not be taught in the classroom. Maybe we'll have an intelligent conversation this next year and a half in the presidential arena about what role public education plays. But I think in Seattle, a blow was struck for reform, and I think we'll benefit from that.
Paul Guppy, the role of education, is the tide turning on what America thinks that role is?
So I have a different sense of it, as you would expect. I should first say that Jonathan is right. My wife and I have worked with great teachers in the public school system. We've had special needs kids. We've worked with counselors. And, you know, on the front line, there are some very talented and caring people. We've had a few duds. But in general, the teachers are very responsive, and they're great to work with because you're trying to put together an education plan for a particular kid who has particular problems. And that works great. The larger issue, I guess I would dissent a little bit, that, you know, going on strikes and it just seems kind of old-fashioned, like an older model of how the economy used to work. And that as the high-tech economy and we have more choice and smartphones and faster communications and Uber and...
Why would it be old-fashioned if every one of you said that the teachers won this strike took 6 days?
Sure, it was a fight and one side won. So, you know, I understand that. And again... Congratulations. It worked for Jonathan and the union, and they accomplished some good things. I'm not disputing that. What I mean is that it's just the style of it just seems something of a throwback. And as there's in other areas of our lives, as there's more and more choice and more connectivity, when you're able to live tweet a radio show.
Which we're doing right now on Twitter,
@KUOW. Right. And... So what I mean is that in so many areas of our lives, it's so empowering for families and individuals to get on a website. As soon as one of my kids hits 18, they're suddenly in a world of choice on education, and they're being solicited by colleges around the country. You know, please apply here. And you just feel like you're more in the driver's seat when it comes to higher education. When you're dealing with traditional K-12 public education, it's more of a constrained kind of central model. And as I said before, one size fits all. It's kind of discouraging to receive a letter in the spring that says your child will be attending X school. And that's based on your address. And you just wish you had more influence and choice within the system.
You know, I just want to say that we are ecstatic to reconnect with the great American history of collective action.
I just want to zoom out on this whole thing. And what I think also happened here is, you know, there has been such a decline of workers' rights. And this strike is similar in some ways to the minimum wage fight, 15 now. Just a pendulum is swinging at the moment more toward, you know, just income inequality or workers' rights. That's what's actually changing, is that for a long time, you couldn't pull this strike off in a recession. No way. But because things are rosy here, the economy is booming, we have time, we have the ability to discuss how do we treat the teachers. And again, it's somewhat luck of timing and economic boom as well, and that change that's going on nationally in a lot of different sectors.
We've been talking about what was accomplished this last week in the Seattle teachers' strike and how much the conversation about teachers and public unions is or is not swinging, what that pendulum's doing in Seattle and nationwide. Any last words on the topic? We've said it all.
Let's go 60 years before we have another strike instead of 30.
You know, I just want to say, of course, striking is the last option. You know, what was not part of this conversation is really how hard we worked since May and, you know, how difficult it was to sort of get the district to move on some issues that are really crucial, and for them to understand how passionate parents were about the issues that we were standing up for.
Jonathan Knapp, president of the Seattle Education Association, thanks for joining us. What's going to happen this weekend? What are the odds of an approval versus a no vote?
I have never been to Las Vegas, and I do not plan to go there.
You seriously don't have an expectation one way or the other?
Well,
of course he does, and he's not going to share it.
Let me help you out here. They're going to approve it.
Right.
Let me just
we are a democratic institution, and the members will decide on Sunday.
Do I get to vote? Because I would say approve it, and let's move on.
We are a democratic organization of membership. They will decide on Sunday.
Speaking of culture wars, is your state Supreme Court too liberal or not liberal enough? That's coming up on KUOW's Week in Review. Join the discussion right now on our Facebook page, KUOW Public Radio. Tweet at us. The at is right in the name, at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. We are debating, learning from the news of the week. Let's do a quick update on rent control, okay? I don't know how much time you want to spend on this, but help the listeners understand. This week, the Seattle City Council debated whether to pass a resolution that would go to the state legislature, calling on legislators to let Seattle decide whether we want rent control, which is now illegal statewide. The vote was tied 3-3. It appears to have, has it stalled at the city council? It will move on. The full council will consider it. But we have all heard the words rent control. But Joni Balter, where do we stand?
So what happens with that 3-3 vote is it's no recommendation to the full council, which will meet maybe in the next week or two to decide if they want to pass this resolution. It sounds like they're not going to pass the resolution, which would be the smart thing to do because rent control doesn't work. And the whole idea isn't going to work anyway because this legislature, as currently constructed, is not going to say, okay, Seattle, whatever you would like. You want rent control even though we don't allow it? You go ahead because we love Seattle so much. Not going to happen. So they can pass all the resolutions they want, and they do pass a fair amount, some of them silly, but not going to happen. I mean, they might pass the resolution by some vote, but the legislature's going to go, thanks for nothing, not interested.
Conservative Paul Guppy, rent well, control, will it happen? Should it happen?
Again, I'm about market choice. But just looking at the science of economics, and Joni did a good job of talking about the process, but just on the idea itself, the reason that rent control doesn't work is because it's a price control. So price controls always distorts markets. Doesn't matter what product you pick, you know, gasoline or bread. If you put a price control on it, it would restrict supply. And that's what happens with rent control. New York started it in the 1940s. San Francisco has done it. So we have a lot of experience in the real world. But it's not hard to see what happens is that with rent control, the market freezes up. So people who have a rent control apartment don't move. You know, they don't free up the unit for the next person. And people who build apartments to provide supply stop doing that. What's the point of building a new apartment building? Because the price is going to be controlled. So it just restricts the ability to deliver new service to the market.
That's conservative Paul Guppy. Liberal. Are you a liberal, Greg Nichols?
Yes.
Okay. Former Seattle mayor.
So.
Greg Nichols, rent control.
Bad idea.
You too.
Yes.
What do you agree? Is it for free market reasons that you just never have price controls?
Shockingly, I find myself in agreement with Paul on this issue. A lot of the building that's going on today is as a result of zoning changes that I advocated as mayor.
Wait, this is your fault?
Well, in part, it's a legacy. Yes, and what we're doing is we're trying to focus growth in the city and not out in the green hills of the Cascades, and we need to provide the supply. On top of that, we have a very vibrant 21st century economy here in Seattle, companies headquartered here in Seattle and in the region that are growing and attracting more people to our region. So we need to have that supply, and rent control would stop new investment from coming into the city and providing those units. I will say that affordable housing and how we do have housing, good housing for teachers to be able to live in our city and others who are providing very, very basic services, how we provide them affordable housing near where they work is a huge challenge. It was in my time as mayor, and it is again today for Mayor Murray.
Right. And I should throw in here that when you come to safety net supports like affordable housing for low-income people, that's not a market issue. That is a social program. So the market can provide housing for whatever it works out to be, 80, 85, 90% of people. But there are people who need community support, and that's what affordable housing is for.
Here's what I don't understand. I just heard unanimity on the left and the right, and Mayor Ed Murray is against rent control. So, and the main argument is that it would make, no, it actually would make housing less affordable for reasons we've discussed. So here, but here are city council members, Shama Sawant and Nick Licata. They can read the same studies that you can. They know what New York is and San Francisco. Mm-hmm. They want housing to be more affordable. Why do you think they're in support of rent control?
They live in 1947.
Come on.
No, I think actually, even though they know that it hasn't really worked anywhere else, that they somehow think that if Seattle does it, it'll be done differently and it'll work. But everybody who's studied rent control in other cities knows that it's not going to happen. It's not going to work. Even let's say the legislature said, oh, sure, whatever you guys want, which they won't. But if they did, it still wouldn't work. But these folks think somehow that we're going to do it better or differently. And
how do you know? Yeah, they say it's modified. It's rent stabilization, and we'll do it in a way that will limit the shocking rent increases that have.
Isn't that a concession that there's a problem with the idea? So they're trying to soften the impact of it. No,
we modify good ideas to make them better.
Nobody here thinks that rents aren't unaffordable in this city. Nobody.
Right.
But that's why that housing task force, even though they had a few screaming duds that they offered, had some other really good ideas that really might increase the housing stock and therefore reduce some of the prices.
Yeah, but they're in favor of those too. It's not either or. I'll give you the last word, former Mayor Nichols.
Well, you just made a statement modifying a good idea. This would be modifying a really bad idea.
I'm not sure you
should start with the bad idea and modify it. I think you might start at the other end.
Okay, so the takeaway there is a consensus against rent control here in this room, left and right and center. But on that Seattle Housing Committee, it was a 3-3 deadlock, and it'll go to the full city council. And even then, we're only talking about a resolution to ask the state to allow something that it doesn't currently allow. Let's do another sort of a quick roundup. I just want to get your quick take on Seawall in trouble. Why should I care? Because this week, the Mayor Murray elaborated on the plan to hire an outside panel of experts to review the Elliott Bay Seawall project, which looks to be delayed by at least a year, costing $71 million more than planned. In case you don't remember, Seattle needs a new seawall because it's old and it's an earthquake risk. I just want to know, why is the seawall project over budget, and how much does it matter that both it and the tunnel are flailing at the same time? Greg Nichols?
Well, the need for a new seawall was identified when I was mayor. We found these little marine critters called gribbles that were eating away at the pilings. And so the need is absolutely there. It's a century-old structure in many parts. And so the idea that you wouldn't have complete control over what you found when you dug in there, I think, is reasonable. I don't know. I haven't been in the meetings. I'm not an insider on the current construction, but it's not a shock to me that they have apparently found some things that they didn't expect, and that's causing both a delay and an increase. They should be held accountable, bringing in outside experts to take a look at what went wrong and make sure it doesn't happen again, I think is great. But it's one of those sort of projects that, like a remodel in your house, once you open up the wall, you really don't know what you're going to find.
Old timber sitting in the water, eaten by gribbles. That sounds hard, Paul Guppy. Do you think it's more than that?
I do, because it just, you know, I don't want to sound negative all the time, but there's just a pattern of where folks in government are not giving us the straight story. So we're asked to vote for a big property tax increase for a project. Those seem to come along constantly. And then it turns out to be 30, 50% over budget or 100%. And The tunnel is 2 years behind.
But Greg Nichols knows a lot about it, and he doesn't even know what the specifics of why this is over budget on what's going to be a difficult project. What makes you so sure that it's – are you saying it's some kind of government malfeasance or waste and fraud?
Well, or a lack of competence. I mean, you know, the ability to plan a project, to account for the unknowns, which every project is going to have. And, it's a little embarrassing that in the past, they seem to be able to build things effectively. I think the original viaduct was built in about 18 months back in the 50s, that the 520 bridge was built for less money originally than it is to plan the new bridge. So there's just a sense that, these projects are taking a long time and they always seem to be over budget. And
why do you think that is?
I just think it's lack of urgency and competence on the part of the people that run the projects. And the problem for the taxpayers of Seattle or the people who live here is that we're talking about how expensive it is to live in Seattle. And yet we have to pay for all of it whenever there's an overrun, whenever there's an increase, either as state, federal, or even local taxpayers, we have to come up with the money to pay for that. And that puts strain on household budgets.
Can I go one step further and say that this should be a warning also about the $930 million transportation levy that's coming? If everything is going to be 20, 30, whatever percent above what we originally said, why don't we start a little smaller on that gigantic thing?
Yeah, good idea.
And do something that we can actually manage. And, there's not a specific project in there that I think is bogus or something like that. But I think that the whole package, and if the voters said no, believe me, they'd be back in about 5 minutes with the next version of this.
Exactly.
Should be ratcheted down to something that's more manageable. It's too big. And I know Greg Nichols and I had this exact same fight years ago when he had Bridging the Gap at $365 million. Did we not, sir?
Can we take a time out?
The good old days.
That was
way back when it was only 300-something. So finally, let's make you mayor again for a moment. I have that power statutorily. Defend that project, or will you? The seawall, the transportation levy, they're saying that there's something rotten, and it's not just the gribble-eaten timbers.
Well, I think we covered the seawall pretty well. When you open up a 100-year-old structure, particularly on the water, you don't know what you're going to get. Review it, bring in outside eyes to see what went wrong, and fix your processes so that you protect yourself.
Okay, we got that.
But whenever you – one of the early things in my first term was a levee on fire stations. And we discovered after a trip to Kobe and looking at their experience with the earthquake there in 1995, that our fire stations would not survive a Kobe-size earthquake. 3/4 of them would fall down. So we put a levy to the voters. We discovered as we were opening up those walls that we had underestimated some of the costs. And as mayor, I owned that. I found ways to bring other dollars to bear in order to keep the promise that had been made to the voters who voted for that levy. Sometimes you have to suck it up and get the job done, despite having relied on the best information that turned out not to be as good as you had hoped. So, you're always going to run into that. I think the key is how you respond to that, how you make sure that you keep that promise and that you protect against it happening again.
That's a former Seattle mayor. You're done now. You're no longer mayor again. It was only a 1 minute appointment. Greg Nichols, Joni Balter, Paul Guppy, discussing the seawall and what's the bigger picture there with transportation projects in this here city. Also down on the waterfront, an otter is using an inhaler, and we'll tell you about that in about 15 minutes on the Week in Review. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. I can think of two people who have or will have eaten a meal at Bill Gates' house, China's president and former Seattle mayor Greg Nichols. As I just learned, he's with us, Joni Balter, Paul Guppy. This week it was confirmed that China's president will come to Seattle, Tacoma, and Everett next week on his way to his first visit to the White House. Not coming to L.A., not San Francisco. Xi Jinping is going to meet with government officials, tour the Boeing Everett plant, go to Bill Gates' house. On the host committee, there is the CEO of Boeing Commercial. the head of Starbucks, Microsoft, the head of the UW, and Assunta Ng, founder and publisher of Seattle Chinese Post and Northwest Asian Weekly, who told me that this visit has personal significance for her.
It means a lot because I was born in China. I think a lot of the Chinese Americans are very excited and happy that President Xi is picking Seattle as the first stop. And we are curious about everything because I got calls from readers. They want to know if his wife is coming and who is he bringing along. And
they want to know about his wife?
Yeah, because his wife is used to be a very famous singer in China, and is a very beautiful woman. And they are very curious about what he thinks about Seattle. So I'm sort of their ears and eyes when I see him next week. So I feel really honored to be in the same company of other welcoming members.
Do you feel pressured too? Are your friends leaning on you to get him into these events?
Yes. We got a lot of calls, you know, can I come? Can I be part of it? Can I go to the airport? Can I, you know, just go to just a meeting? Can I hand him a letter? Can I shake his hand? But we have no authority, and I don't think anybody from the street can go and meet the Chinese president.
May I ask you approximately how long ago you were born in China?
Oh, my gosh. That's a very personal question, but it's a long, long time ago, more than 50 years.
I ask because I wonder what you think of the changes you have seen in China and Chinese-U.S. relations over your lifetime here.
Wow, that's a big question. I don't remember much, but I did remember I was in going to preschool, and every one of the kids, they had to do exercise together, like group exercise. That's all I remember, not that much. But I went back in 1980, and I saw China was very backward, very old, and very dirty. And I didn't really feel good at all. Before, when I went, my relatives, they all asked me to give them money, to give them gifts, because they were poor. They had nothing. But now, when I visit China, my relatives have more money than me. Can you imagine? They are doing so well. They don't need me to take care of them. So you can know, you know, the great changes that has happened in the Chinese society by just looking at our relatives. And they all want to talk about to come here to have a chance to be educated in the U.S. So I presume after the visit, I know that there would be a lot more Chinese students wanted to come to study in Washington State, in Seattle and Bellevue, for instance.
A more personal look at next week's visit from the Chinese president, from Assunta Ng, founder and publisher of Seattle Chinese Post and Northwest Asian Weekly, who you know, Greg Nichols.
Sure.
And you welcomed a Chinese leader yourself.
Yes, President Hu chose Seattle as a stopping off point on his way to a similar meeting in Washington, D.C. a few years ago. I had an opportunity, along with my wife Sharon, to welcome him at the Olympic Hotel. The streets were lined with protesters, and I assume some well-wishers as well, but protesters from many different perspectives. And I think he was a little flummoxed by that. It was very peaceful, and we had a good, you know, presence. People were on the sidewalks, very civil. But I think it was unusual for him to be greeted in that fashion, and I don't know what his reaction to it was, but hopefully it gave him some pause for thought, and hopefully Seattle will give him some reason to remember us equally positively this time.
Well, that's an interesting point. Amnesty International says 500,000 people are undergoing punitive detention without charge or trial. Millions have no access to the legal system. I'm quoting, harassment, surveillance, house arrest, imprisonment of human rights defenders on the rise, censorship of the internet and other media, repression of Tibetans, Uyghurs, Mongolians, Falun Gong, Christians. China is the leading executioner in the world. Who thinks that there will be protests? I mean, I just don't hear anybody talking about human rights violations hardly anymore now that China's so rich. What'll happen when this leader comes?
Well, we certainly have our own issues with the largest imprisoned population in the world by far. So I'm not sure that we're the place that is going to give the best and most effective pushback. But there are lots of people
wait
with
a minute.
Lots
wait
of
a minute.
Different points.
We have trials. You know,
we do
provide
have trials.
People with lawyers.
We do,
and we
convict people of color to a much higher extent than we do people who are white. So,
but are you making that equation to the point where you think that there won't be or should not be significant human, you know, protest of this leader's visit
no,
like
there
was?
There should be. I'm just not sure that the United States as a that we are the shining light on this issue. We have significant institutional racism that we have not dealt with as a society. But there will be protests.
Absolutely.
Predict they will be peaceful, and I predict that they will be able to get their message out, and we'll see where it goes from there. I think it's great for Seattle, though, that we are being picked as the spot again for that layover. They'll be able to see, you know, Boeing and Microsoft and all of our great companies, and hopefully some business will be transacted at some of those meals.
So clearly, other cities on the West Coast must have bid for this, shall we say, honor to have the president come through. And it is great for the state of Washington, you know. And what I think happens here, you know, there's many heavy topics to discuss once Xi Jinping goes to Washington, D.C. But here you think it's, you know, it's about the business. Yes, there'll be human rights stuff. But it's about some of the business that can be conducted. It's about soft diplomacy, if you want to use that term. Bill Gates is known for really favoring that. And Bill Gates is, as you said, having dinner with Xi Jinping. So one of the reasons we were picked, I'm imagining, has to do with the fact that the former Chinese ambassador, Gary Locke, is from here. He was involved in bringing him here, as was the former governor, Christine Gregoire.
Final word on the Chinese leader's visit, which we'll cover much more next week, Paul Guppy.
Well, I recognize both aspects of it. On the one hand, it's fantastic, as Joni mentions, that the leader of China, which is, you know, the largest country by population in the world, second largest economy in the world now. And also it taps into our history of the Puget Sound as a gateway to Asia. We have always had that attitude outward looking to the world, welcoming to the world. And I think that represents that. So it is a great honor. I think it's important. Diplomacy and connection with other countries is always important. It increases understanding. But I think we also have to recognize that China is not a free country. And so, you know, America has its problems, but none of us are going to go to jail for criticizing the U.S. government. We couldn't have this conversation in China itself. And I just think we need to be sensitive to the fact that Chinese people don't have the same kind of rights and protections that we have here in the U.S.
The Chinese president will be in Seattle and Everett and Tacoma next week on his way to New York City and the United Nations. And you'll hear all about it on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Join the discussion at our Facebook page, KUOW Public Radio, and we are live tweeting the show at KUOW. Two more topics to round up this week's news. Next one in a moment. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Out of control liberals? The state Supreme Court has, of course, told the legislatures that they're in contempt of court for not adequately funding public education. They recently ruled charter schools unconstitutional, even though almost every state has them. One of the legislature's more conservative Republicans has filed for an initiative to require that justices recuse themselves when litigants have donated more than $1,000. There is a line of thinking that the state Supreme Court needs to be reined in. I'll start with free market think tanker Paul Guppy to amplify on that.
Sure. So I'm going to try to be, you know, political science objective about this just by looking at the way governments work and our three branches of government and what are their role, because I think there is a way to do that. So the reason that Representative Manweller, a Republican, is frustrated is because there's a pattern of cases that haven't gone his way. So maybe he's pushing back, trying to send a signal to the court, you know, change whatever to affect maybe what he thinks is the wrong direction of the court. But I think separate from that, there is a way to look objectively, you know, to stand back and see that there is a pattern, I think, of the court getting into areas that are not the role of any court in any state. And
like what?
Well, getting into the details of how education policy should work, for example.
But that's in the Constitution. Isn't that the state Supreme Court's exact role to say you're not funding education
exactly
as it's laid out in the Constitution?
Right, and then you're done. So it is the role of the court to say you're not following the Constitution, and this is the provision, and this is where you failed. But the problem with the McCleary process that I see after 3 years is that the court is not set up to hear from constituents, hold committee hearings, to forge legislation, make deals, you know, whip roll call votes, send something to the governor, he vetoes it, it goes back, you change it again, you send it to him. So elected legislatures are very good at that, and courts are not. So I'm just, again, trying to be objective and say I think there's a point where judges try to get too much into the details of setting policy rather than ruling on what the law says or the Constitution. That is definitely their role. That was fine in McCleary. There's a lot of argument about the charter school case as to whether that was rightly decided based on the 1909 opinion of what common schools means. So there's definitely a dispute there. And I think it's putting these together, which is what critics are starting to see, that the court is overstepping its bounds and getting into an area that maybe they shouldn't work in.
We pay a lot of attention to who appointed the U.S. Supreme Court justices. We know they can be partisan. Joni Balter, has the state Supreme Court overstepped its bounds into excessive partisanship?
I think one thing you want to look at when you're talking about activism in judges is, here's the dividing line. Are they legislating or are they interpreting?
Right.
That's the key definition here. So far, probably not walking across that line. They were a little bit intrusive, you'd say, with the timing of the charter school case. The Friday before the Labor Day, if I have the timing right, for just absolutely stomping on charter schools. But I am thinking very much about Hugh Spitzer, who's a legal expert in our state who people often consult. And he said what you said originally here is that we decide that somebody's activist if they rule the way that we don't like it. And so, you know, that's another thing. And if you want to get to this, you can also talk about should we elect these judges? Because actually the voters don't know the judges. If your last name is Johnson, you win. So if you want to run, you have that name change. You know, so it is a whole thing there. And I have one other point on this, and that is, let's say governors appointed judges, as they do in some other states. There wouldn't be any more Republicans who serve as justices, because there hasn't been a Republican governor in this state for decades. So I don't know how that fixes that problem.
Well, I've heard that could be done by district so that you represent. So here's a justice from Eastern Washington, right?
One idea is to just there are already three federal judicial districts in the state that exist now. So you could have three judges from Eastern Washington and three from Southwest Washington and three from the Puget Sound area, just to bring in some balance without going to a partisan distinction.
Okay, we have an asthmatic sea otter waiting on us, so I just want to wrap up this discussion. Anything on about state Supreme Court, Greg Nichols?
Well,
partisan?
There is not a right answer whether you elect or appoint. There are strengths and weaknesses to both processes. I think the idea that you applaud the court when it intervenes in a way that agrees with your own philosophy and you pillory them when they go against it is absolutely right. I found myself cheering for a conservative United States Supreme Court when they ruled the way I thought they should on the Affordable Care Act. How they stumbled into that, I don't know. I think on balance it's worked well for the history of this state. We have a unique constitution, and I don't see a reason to mess with it.
We'll keep watching that, too, on KOW's Week in Review. Our final topic is that King TV reported this week the Seattle Aquarium as the first known sea otter to be diagnosed with asthma, which she apparently developed last month when the smoke from wildfires drifted over from eastern Washington. How does that happen, and what does it mean for other animals, including human animals? Seattle Aquarium veterinarian Dr. Lasana Lahner, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
How does an otter get asthma from eastern Washington fire smoke?
Well, it's hard to say, and we'll never know exactly whether she developed the asthma when she was exposed to the smoke or whether she had it before and the smoke actually just triggered an asthma attack.
I see. Have you heard of this happening in pets or Woodland Park Zoo animals or human beings?
Well, we definitely know that the common domestic cat gets asthma quite frequently, and other animals such as horses also develop asthma.
Now, I said that Mishka is the first sea otter to have asthma that we know of. How do you get a sea otter to use an inhaler as you are?
Well, it's all through positive reinforcement. So rewarding her for putting her nose up against the inhaler chamber and taking a breath is how we're working on this. And she is doing great.
How's she doing staying underwater? That would seem like a problem.
She's on systemic medication right now to help her with the inflammation, and she's acting like a normal otter, diving and swimming. And as soon as we get her transitioned fully to the inhaler, I'm sure she'll be doing well on that as well.
Well, good. And because I'm self-centered, what does any of this mean for human health?
Well, you know, it's kind of that One Health approach. We know that there's a connection between the health of people and the health of other species. We share the same environment. So if we see a health issue in a non-human animal, we know that that's probably important for humans as well.
I didn't know sea otters were, they used to live here and now they don't. They disappeared.
Well, they're back on the coast of Washington. They are back, but we did hunt them to extinction on the Washington coast, actually, for their coats. But they were reintroduced from sea otters from Alaska, and now we have a population of around 1,000 on the outer coast of Washington.
Well, really, we're wishing Mishka the best. My nephew got made fun of for using an inhaler. Is there any sign that other otters are razzing Mishka in any way?
Or? Not that
taking
we
her lunch
tell.
Money.
Not that we can tell, but I do hope this offers some inspiration to kids who have asthma and are learning to use or use an inhaler on a regular basis.
Veterinarian Dr. Lasan Alaner from Seattle Aquarium, wishing you and Mishka the best. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
KUOW's Week in Review with the former mayor of this town, Greg Nichols, and Paul Guppy from the Washington Policy Center, and Joni Balter from the Seattle Channel from Civic Cocktail. Thanks for coming and making us smart about the news heading into the weekend.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
We all breathe easier that Mishka's doing better.
Yeah, I think so. Our producer is Jason Pagano. Bernard Ouellette is the engineer. Jack Walters this time around. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in, and please join us next week for the Week in Review.